It's the Troopany Show with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This is my show, and we're at the office today after a bunch of technological problems, as usual when I record at my office, but we're all good now. And I have Mr. Alex Edwards with me. How are you, sir?
Hello, I'm good. It's earlier than we usually record, so I'm waking up, I've got coffee, but I'm ready to go, I'm ready to get into some old Japan.
Yeah, today we're back with the beginner's guide of Japanese wrestling, and we're looking at the Real World Tag League, or World's Strongest Determination Tag League, which was its official title. But Giant Baba did like the English for his promotional work. And this is the 1990 edition. Now, it was a big tournament. In fact, it was arguably the best tag team tournament ever put together. And it was one of those confluences of events. Now, we talked a lot more about All Japan's early days earlier in this particular series. But what's your overall impressions, Alex? Where is All Japan Pro Wrestling at this time in 1990?
Well, at this time, they're one of the big two in Japan, really, aren't they? And they've really established themselves as the place to be for a lot of gaijin or foreigners going to work in Japan.
Yeah.
They're running some pretty big shows at this time. So the finals of this tournament was at the Budokan, which is a pretty big venue. They're really starting to, or they have, hit their stride and gearing up for that sort of the massive dream run of the 90s.
Yeah, you have kind of like the start of King's Road. We keep talking about the start of King's Road. And the last two times, a couple of times, we talked about me and Chelsea and Marcus talked about Junichi Tenryu and Jumbo Tsuruta. And they were kind of the foundations of King's Road. And this is where King's Road starts to get itself together. The four pillars of All Japan Pro Wrestling, Kawada, Tayu, Misawa, and Kobashi are all in this tournament. And they're all jockeying for position to be the next big star. Also at this point, Jinrichi Tenryu has left the company to form Super World Sports. So there's a big gaping hole as far as like the ace of the company is concerned. And who was going to be that ace going forward? Were they going to fall back on Jumbo Tsuruta, or were they going to make somebody new? And that's what this tournament kind of is about, really, because the names in this tournament aren't just big tag teams. They're big singles wrestlers as well. All Japan didn't really have that dichotomy of tag teams being one thing and singles wrestlers being another. You know, matches were matches, and that's, you know, getting the best people for the best teams was really how it was put together. You had different layers of tag teams as well, because you had two tag team divisions, more or less. You had the All Asian Tag Team titles and the World Tag Team Championships. So this was an interesting state of play to where tag wrestling in All Japan was at the time. And in this tournament, the tournament was presented as for 10,000 yen, the tournament trophy, and the World Tag Team Championships, which had been vacated before the tournament started. This was a general tradition in All Japan Pro Wrestling. So the winner would literally win everything. So it was really important to how the production of All Japan Pro Wrestling would go forward. So we're going to go team by team to kind of explain what they're all about, and we'll talk about the matches we see as we go along. And we're going to go in reverse order of how they stood in the final. So the team that finished with 2 points was Mighty Inoue and Rusha Kimura. Yes, Rusha Kimura is still wrestling in 1990. I'm doing all right. It was okay, this tag team. I thought they were cool. They're kind of like long-standing mainstays of the mid-card in All Japan Pro Wrestling. Obviously, they came from that other wrestling promotion in the 1970s, International. So they weren't as well known as, you know, they were well known to the Japanese audience, but they're maybe not as well known to everybody else. What did you think of this team, Alex?
I mean, yeah, pretty much what you just said. They're both solid guys. I only saw one match of them in this tournament, and they were against Abdullah the Butcher and Kamala. And so it may not have been the best example of their work, as a lot of the time they were just bumping around for the bigger guys. But no, I like Mighty Inoue as sort of this fiery underdog against these bigger guys in this match I saw, at least. And yeah, they're just a solid team to get in there to have some decent matches in a tournament where you've got how many teams was it? 12, was it?
Yeah, 10? 12 teams, I think.
12. So, yeah, when you've got 12 teams, you need just someone to have decent matches with everyone. And I think that's one of the roles these guys filled.
Yeah, definitely. And they were good ballast to the bottom of the card, basically. Next up, also who scored two points, was some NWA stalwarts, Dick Slater, or Dirty Dick Slater, who's probably better known, and Joel Deaton. Now, Joel Deaton is still wrestling to this day, 27 years later. As you know,
how old is he now?
Oh, I looked it up just to make sure that I wasn't dreaming that he was actually still wrestling. And I guess he must be in his 50s, his 60s now. But he certainly had a couple of matches last year on some veterans cards, some convention shows. So, you know, it's interesting times. A guy like Joel Deaton can still put some matches together. They scored 2 points. And they were kind of like your standard American cowboy team, really. They were heels and they did their heelish thing.
Yeah, pretty much. They're, in a way, filling that same role of Inoue and Kimura as the sort of just the baby faces just to go in there and have matches, except these are the heel counterparts.
Yeah, that's it, really. Next up was an interesting team, Blade Butch Masters and Skywalker Nitron. Really tall guys.
Two really tall guys wearing Road Warriors face paint for some reason and just being a bit crap.
Yeah, fantastic mullets, I have to say.
There are a lot of mullets on these cards.
Yeah, nearly as many mullets as FMW shows. And I think FMW kind of take the cake when it comes to mullets. Me and Chelsea have this thing called Mullet Watch when we're reviewing shows and on Twitter, and FMW takes the cake. But All Japan were giving FMW a good run for their money in this particular tournament, certainly. Interesting side notes on these guys. Skywalker Nitron actually did have a run in WCW just before the Monday Nitro era. And part of the reasoning for that was because he was in the first X-Men movie. He was Sabretooth.
Oh, yeah. I did not know that.
There you go, you see. Yeah, he was the original Sabretooth, not the good one from from the Wolverine Origin movie. You know, the Wolverine Origin movie was not great, but that was probably the best role in it. But he was actually the original Sabretooth in X-Men, the first X-Men movie. Didn't say much, as you can probably imagine.
Well, I don't know, maybe his performance there was better than it was from what I saw of him here, where this team were basically just, they're two big men, that's it.
Yeah, and when they were introduced, because they actually have kind of like a ceremony to introduce them at the beginning of the tournament, and the crowd were like, oh, because they've clearly never seen anything quite like it before in their lives.
Yeah, especially when you've got these two, you know, giant foreigners here, it's a bit of a spectacle, but then the match starts, and yeah.
And it was interesting how they were dealt with by the other teams. So we'll get to them as they go through, because now we are into the serious end of proper wrestling teams. The next team up who scored 6 points was the British Bruisers, Johnny Smith and the Dynamite Kid. Now, Dynamite and Davey Boy Smith had a bit of a falling out, Dynamite found another tag team partner in Johnny Smith, who he tagged with in Calgary and Stampede and also in Japan, in All Japan as well. In fact, Dynamite helped Johnny get a job in All Japan Pro Wrestling. And they were a workhorse team. And Dynamite is so over, so ridiculously over with the Japanese fans, who still love and adore him. This is 7 years after his heyday, and he is notably slowing down at this particular point. I think he noted in his book, this was around the time where he got off the steroids and started cleaning up his act a little bit to try and save his body. But he's still got that intensity, and he's still got that drive that wants him to be the best wrestler in the world. And Johnny Smith is a very good and very capable wrestler. He is very much like Davey Boy Smith and is greatly in the Wigan mold. He's one of those guys. Barely does not have as much charisma as Davey Boy did, certainly, and maybe not quite the ring generalship of Dynamite or Davey Boy, but an exceptionally talented wrestler. Had a run in ECW much later in 1993 as well. So what did you think of this team?
I really like this team. Like you said, Dynamite Kid was so over at the time, and he still had all the technical ability that he had during his peak period. And Johnny Smith was someone that I hadn't really seen much of before watching a few of these matches, but I really liked him. I thought he had the same sort of technical ability, maybe not as much, but he was still very, very good. He added a bit of that sort of high flying in there, which made it a little bit more exciting to watch. And yeah, I came out of it really wanting to see some more of him. And doing a bit of research on him, it looks like he stuck around in All Japan right through to the 2000s. He'd come back. He'd be sort of a regular staple of this tournament for the next 10 years or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. It's one thing that we kind of probably brush over, but All Japan Pro Wrestling was a good source of income for a lot of wrestlers for a very long time. If Baba liked you and thought you was worth it, he would spend the money to keep you for as long as he possibly could. You know, this was guys like Johnny Smith, guys like Rushi Kimura, certainly guys like Inoue, all these people who are kind of around the mid-card for extended periods of time in All Japan Pro Wrestling are there because they're good quality. You know, they can deliver the kind of matches that Baba's looking for. They can tell the stories that Baba wants. They understand the system. And quite frankly, they're on that much money, they could do 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, 13 weeks of the year, and not have to wrestle for anyone else. You know, so it was good for them. It was good for the company. Now, the style's a bit stiff, don't get me wrong, and it probably didn't conduct them to wrestling anywhere else anyway. But, you know, there was plenty of opportunities there. This was a good business organization as far as wrestling concerned. I was having a quick look around earlier, and Jim Cornette described All Japan Pro Wrestling in this time period as Giant Baba being the second richest promoter on the planet who made more money presenting wrestling as a real sport for longer than anyone else did. And he needed the tools to do the job. And Johnny Smith was an excellent tool for doing this particular job with.
Definitely, for sure.
Right then, we move on to the next team is Abdullah the Butcher and Giant Kamala 2. That's the Giant Kamala from the WWE latter days. Now, honestly, you would think, right, these guys are not going to be any good because they're not going to try. They're gimmick guys. They're everything you kind of like say is wrong about All Japan Pro Wrestling. They cannot possibly fit. But first of all, Kamala comes to the ring wearing knee pads for a start, and I've never seen him wrestling wearing knee pads. And Abdullah's on it. He's after it. He's trying to put in the best performance of his career every time he goes out there. And they have some cracking matches in this tournament. I was so impressed with this team. They were so ridiculously good, and you just don't expect it for what they were trying to do. What did you reckon, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, Kamala, I could definitely see, was putting the effort in and was really going for it. But Abdullah, maybe it was just the stuff I saw from him. Maybe I didn't see the same as you. But he just seemed like Abdullah, quite slow, quite messy, bleeding a lot. Just there was one particular moment we'll get to later on, but it was during a match with Inoue and Kimura where I can't remember which one of them he lifted up for some sort of like a Samoan drop or something, but he lifted them up and just sort of dropped them and then sort of stumbled and fell on top of them for a pin. And it was just like, what are you doing? I mean, Kamala, yes, he was good. Abdullah, maybe not so much.
Well, I mean, one of my favorite matches in the tournament is Dynamite and Johnny versus Abdullah and Kamala, because Dynamite and Johnny just jumped them before the start because, well, you do it to us, so we'll do it to you.
that's why I like that Dynamite and Johnny team, because they had those where they'd have these sort of technical classic matches, but then they'd show that they are legitimately smart wrestlers and they'd try and outthink their opponents and think, right, how are we going to beat this specific team? Right, with these guys, we're just going to have to jump them and throw everything got at them.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like that they're that versatile, that they can have sort of a different style of match with everyone they face.
Yeah, and it really played to Abdullah and Kamala's strengths as well, because it was a brawl. It wasn't a wrestling match. It did kind of break down into a wrestling match later on, but the first opening 5 minutes is Dynamite trying to split Abdullah open as quickly as possible, and he manages it, of course. There is blood everywhere, and not long after that, Dynamite is bleeding like a stuck pig as well. Also notable that Abdullah and Dynamite were really close friends, and I think he was friends with Kamala as well, because I don't think some of this match would have been as good otherwise. You know, when Dynamite retired from All Japan Pro Wrestling, it was Abdullah that bought him the gold watch when he left the company. So, you know, that they are really, really good friends, and that kind of like seeps through in this match, because Dynamite is selling for a gimmick guy, which doesn't always happen if you look at his career.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was an interesting match, to say the least. And, yeah, I think you should really have a look at this one. If you don't watch the whole tournament, watch Dynamite and Johnny Smith versus Kamala and Abdullah the Butcher. So the next team that finished on 10 points was the very young Johnny Ace and Kenta Kobashi. Now, Kenta Kobashi was on a bit of the kind of in the start of his major push. He was still on his losing streak. So this was a really heartfelt performance from him. Johnny Ace had just come off his run in WCW as part of the Dynamic Dudes, the worst tag team of all time, featuring really talented wrestlers. Now, you guys may know Johnny Ace because his real name is John Laurinaitis, brother of our Road Warrior Animal and former Talent Relations Director for the WWE, and would actually have a major influence on pro wrestling over the next 10 years, was also Makoto Baba's favorite wrestler. As Jim Cornette dismissively put it, the nice little blonde-haired, blue-eyed Gaijin who always ends up being the female director's favourite, which is mildly sexist. But it's Jim, and that's his feelings. And also, you know, he had a lot of things to do with John Laurinaitis. But certainly this was a tag team that was way better than the Dynamic Dudes.
Yeah, for sure. I really like these guys where it's, like you said, the two younger guys, both pretty high-flying, like, Kobashi's moonsault is a thing of beauty.
Yeah.
Every time he hit that, I was just in awe because it just looked absolutely perfect every time. And Johnny Ace as well, where I always... So my first introduction to Johnny Ace was as John Laurinaitis in the WWE. And then going back and looking at some Dynamic Dude stuff, it was a bit like, he's a bit cheesy. He's a bit sort of, you know... Not really sure why this guy's raved about so much. And then seeing him in this team here, he's doing some really great stuff. Like, he's flying all over the place. He's hitting ace crushers. It's great. I really enjoyed this team. I thought they were one of the highlights of the tournament as this sort of this younger, spunky team really coming out and putting in some great performances.
Certainly there were, and for those of you who don't know what an ace crusher is, it's a cutter, it's a diamond cutter, or it's a stone cutter. I can't remember Steve Austin's finishing maneuver now. That's I'm really
stunner.
Having a good... It's a stunner. There you go. It's a stunner. It's, you know, it's where he got it from, because Michael Hayes actually, you know, borrowed it from All Japan Pro Wrestling, and Steve Austin started using it as his finisher on the advice of Michael Hayes, and
along with what? So we've got. From just this move, you've got the Ace Crusher, then you've got the Diamond Cutter, you've got the Stone Cold Stunner, you've got the Twist of Fate, you've got the RKO, you've got the Koji Cutter. How many more are there?
Hundreds.
There's so many moves that are all come from this move that Johnny Ace did.
Yeah, it is quite remarkable. And his kind of version kind of looks a little clumsy compared to how you do it now. Because he did it down to his knees, which is actually probably safer on your spine, to be honest. So, yeah, very influential wrestler. Not necessarily the most liked influential wrestler in the wrestling industry, but certainly very influential.
I mean, maybe not liked outside of the ring, but inside the ring, he was really good. And yeah. You can see why he was so influential.
Okay, we'll move on to the next tag team, which was quite the interesting outfit. And two of the biggest draws in professional wrestling history tagging together. Andre the Giant and Giant Baba taking 14 points and not disgracing themselves. And clearly, Andre the Giant is having the time of his life throughout this tournament because he gets to hit people really hard and have fun wrestling with his best mate, Baba. And that was what I really enjoyed about this tournament, was watching Baba and Andre like banging heads. It was cool.
Yeah, so this was your sort of fun nostalgia team where... Both guys obviously quite limited at this point in their careers, but they're both just out there to have fun, and they're both out there putting on the best performances they can. They're really putting the effort in. Like you said, Andre's having a great time out there. You can see that he's really enjoying himself, and Baba as well. And they had some good performances here. Like, for how limited they both were, they actually had some legitimately good matches throughout this tournament.
Yeah, certainly. And I think also, you know, it shows the amount of respect Andre and Baba had from everybody else. I mean, you've got Steve Williams and Terry Gordy, two of the hottest properties in wrestling at the time, and certainly the hottest tag team in the world at the time. And they sell for them really, really a lot more than they should do, really. You know, and everyone in this tournament looks after them. What was really interesting was when they're wrestling Masters and Skywalker, and you expect it to be a big slobber knockers kind of a match, and Baba and Andre just start chain wrestling them. it's bizarre. It's just like, okay, how can we beat these guys? Well, they're probably about as powerful as we are, so in kayfabe terms, so let's just out wrestle them. We've been around longer. So you've got Giant Baba trying to drop toe hold this 6'7", 6'10" guy who clearly doesn't know how to cope with it. And Andre and Giant Baba doing double arm levers as a double team maneuver is just like, what? But it makes sense. Like you said, the veteran team were better wrestlers than they are. These are green kids. We'll show them. And that's what they did.
Yeah, it all comes down to that. The psychology of wrestling, that magical term, where they are just thinking, what would actually make sense for us to do here? And how would we legitimately beat these guys if this was a real fight? And that's how you do it. You out technique them.
Yeah, exactly. And there were some other class performances with Doc and Gordy as well. You know, that was a really, really good match. Well worth watching. Now, the next team is really kind of an example of where All Japan was at the time, because obviously the Gaijins are cool and everything, but the money's in your homegrown talent. And so the next team is this team of Akira Tayu and Jumba Tsuruta. Well, Jumba Tsuruta was just really calming down and coming off being the ace of the company, and Tayu was one of the rising stars. So teaming them together was a smart move, and they were an incendiary tag team. They were absolutely incredible. But also, you do also get the notice that they're building Tayu to something special because he loses everything. If there's a pin to be had, it's Tayu gets pinned. But that isn't necessarily a bad thing in All Japan Pro Wrestling, because you can build somebody that way. And certainly Jumbo, we talked about Dynamite being over, but Jumbo walking into a hall was like God entering the room. So this was a really interesting team to watch and kind of really give us an idea of what All Japan was doing at the time.
Yeah, these guys were fantastic. Like you said, as soon as Jumbo walked into the venue, the crowd erupted. It was just crazy how over he was, where every time he'd get a tag, they would explode. It was really something to see. And Tawei, it's like you said, he was at the time sort of up and coming, and he was really putting in some really great performances and showing that he was something special and he was really destined for great things. And I really enjoyed this team. I thought these guys were one of the highlight teams of the whole tournament. They were both really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, the matches with Stan Hansen and Dan Spivey and with Doc and Gordy are just absolutely phenomenal. Definitely. They're kind of like, they really encapsulate what Japanese tag team wrestling was about at the time. And also, when you watch these matches, we should probably talk about this at this moment as well. These are not like North American tag matches where there's a formula, okay? And there's nothing wrong with a formula, because DIY and The Revival in NXT have been doing the same formula for the last year, and it's worked with some variations exceptionally well. But a lot of it is just what is old is new again. They're doing what the Midnight Express and the Rock and Roll Express did 20 years before. So it's that formula of the faces are dominant for a while, the heels are dominant for a while, the faces are dominant for a while, then the heels take over and grind down the faces, there's a hot tag from the faces and you go to the finish. That doesn't really happen that much in these matches. These matches are much more back and forth. There's much less selling going on in one sense, because the idea behind the matches is it's going to take an awful long while to grind you down. So just because someone's been dominant for a while, it doesn't mean that they can't come back from underneath without even having to tag out. Quite often you see guys take a lot of punishment and still stay in the ring and then get dominant before they tag somebody else in.
Yeah, that was definitely something I noticed, where there was somewhat of a formula to quite a few of the matches, where you would have one team's on offense, then it switches. But it was a lot more switches than like you said, than a standard North American tag match. And I like that. It made it because this is meant to be, this is a tournament for the world tag team titles. They're meant to be these really important things. Everyone wants them. And so everyone is fighting as hard as they can to win these matches and to get to these finals of these tournaments. And so I like that the matches themselves are structured in a way that anyone could beat anyone, because you would have moments of hope and moments of shine from both teams at all times, multiple times throughout the same match. So you'd never have one where it's so one-sided, you're like, right, these guys are definitely losing, or, oh, yeah, then these guys are going to come back and win. It was always, you're on the edge of your seat, like, oh, now this guy's on, but now this guy's on, now this guy, now this guy. And it just kept going back and forth, and it made the matches a lot more interesting to watch. And we were talking about Saruta and Tawari and how good they were, and they really mastered that, where they could be selling forever, but then one of them would just hit one move, the crowd would erupt, and then they'd be on offense, and it would be perfect.
Yeah, yeah. It's poetry in motion to watch, because the crowd is so into it as well. You know, they've really bought into what, everything that's been the story that's been told before them. Now, the next team is arguably the greatest tag team in Japanese pro wrestling history, and they are Gaijin, Dory Funk Jr. and Terry Funk, former champions of this tournament a couple of times by this point. At the end of their careers, we thought at the time.
About that.
Dory Funk Jr. is actually still appearing on All Japan cards some 27 years later, and Terry Funk is, well, he's Terry Funk. Dory Funk Jr. is still beating the aces of the company 27 years later. let's point that out.
And at this time in 1990, he looked about 70 years old.
Yeah, he doesn't look that much different now. Really, he doesn't. So they were amazing, because they were obviously, they knew how to get the most out of everything in this tournament and the best out of the wrestlers they were facing with the minimal of effort. Now, there was a match we talked about before we came on air that you didn't like and I loved. So do you want to give your case, then I'll give mine.
Okay, so you've got the Funks, as we said, legendary tag team, greatest of all time. And then you've got Butch Masters and Skywalker Nitron, two big guys who are not the greatest of all time. Going into it, this was the first match I watched of the tournament, and it was the first time I'd ever seen Masters and Nitron. So I didn't really have an opinion of them at the time. I just saw them as two big guys, and they're going against the Funks. So let's see what they can do. And the match was quite basically structured, I guess. It was very much big man versus small man. The Funks are the underdogs against these two big guys. They brawl around, and then one of the big guys, can't remember which one, got a bear hug on Dory that went on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Until he finally tags in Terry, who fires up, hits some lariats, gets the spinning toe hold on Nitron. Everyone's loving it, but then Butch Masters runs in, breaks that up, and then for some reason out of nowhere, Dory gets a Thez press on Butch Masters and gets the win. It was like, what's going on? It was just sort of, I could see what they were going for with the big man small man thing, but it just sort of all got a bit lost, and then it ended, and I was like, what did I just watch?
Okay.
It worked for the crowd, because the crowd was so into everything the Funks did. Every single time the Funks hit even a punch, they would go crazy.
Yeah.
And I can definitely appreciate that. But I don't know, just as a match, it didn't really do much for me.
Well, you see, this is the thing why I think it's absolute genius, is because at the beginning of the match, Terry tags in, and essentially, he makes a spot out of running away for 10 minutes, or for about 5 minutes. They make no contact. Every time they try and tie up, Terry slides out the ring, and Butch Masters tries to back him out of the corner, and Skywalker's a legal man, and he tries to back him into the ring. and they literally make a spot out of not doing anything for 5 minutes, and that's just genius. That is only
there was a lot of stalling.
Yeah, that is only something Terry Funk could come up with. I think I actually did count at one point because I live tweeted this when I was watching it, and there was something like we were 9 minutes into the match, and at that point there'd been a drop toe hold, a bear hug, and 5 forearms, and that was it. And anytime you've got a crowd on the edge of its seat doing that.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I'm just saying, that was me. That was my kind of thought on it.
Maybe I need to give it another watch now that I've got that sort of mindset. I don't know. At the time, it didn't do much for me.
I suppose as well, you're kind of like, looking back on it 27 years later, you're like, you know the history and how much influence this card had on pro wrestling. And you've got like Doc and Gordy versus Tayu and Saruta, and all these cracking matches are on there, and then you've got this in the middle of it, and it seems so other compared to them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah, but Dory and Terry on cracking form, though they are kind of grinding down a little bit at this particular point, but they do a credible job of getting other people over, which is really what they're there for. Speaking of getting people over.
Well, you say that, but they came joint third.
Well, yeah, true. But then again, I see, this is the thing. I was also watching an interview with Stan Hansen before we did today the podcast today, and one thing he did point out about Japanese wrestlers was they weren't bothered about their image, right? So yeah, as much as they weren't bothered about doing jobs for people because, well, I've got so much respect, it doesn't matter if I lose to this guy. It can only help that guy, which will help me. So they had the right attitude to the business. So, and the Funks and kind of instilled that in when they were training people as well. So to me, it was like they were getting people over even though the other people were losing, because to last that long with Dorian Terry Funk means you must be good.
True. That is very true.
Okay, then. So speaking of, like I said, the younger teams who were there, the most interesting team, I think, in this entire tournament, though they didn't win, was Toshiaki Kawada and Mitsuharu Misawa, who would be the main draws and aces for the company during All Japan's golden period. So they were quite good at this.
Just a little bit. They were yeah. They were all right, weren't they?
Yeah, they were really good. And there's moments of sheer genius in this match, in this tournament from then. You can see there, I think they were wrestling Spivey and Hansen at one point. Misawa goes for a dive outside the ring, stops himself, flips over the top rope, lands on the apron as Spivey gets out of the way, and then when Spivey's in range, goes with a flying forearm off the apron. And it's all done within a flowing motion of like 2 seconds. He's thinking on his feet all the time. Kawada is doing incredible things with his kicks. You know, Kawada has a reputation for being stiffer than stiff, and he really, really was in this tournament. But it kind of shows how much pressure they were under to deliver, because they were going to be the next stars. And if they needed to put a strong performance into this particular tournament.
Yeah, these guys were great. Like you said, that spot with Misawa doing the flips over the ropes came out of nowhere. I was like, what is going on? But it was fantastic. Kawada, those kicks and knees were just brutal looking throughout. And you can see that these guys, like you said, are really trying to prove that they belong and prove that they can be the top stars. And I think they did a pretty good job of doing that. They looked great throughout this tournament. They really looked like they could have gone all the way. I wouldn't have batted an eyelid if they had just won the whole thing. They really did fit. And yeah, a fantastic team and two fantastic wrestlers.
Yeah, they were quite incredible, and I recommend all of the matches they had in this tournament because they were all good. Even against Kamala and Abdullah, they were good. So the next two teams are the finalists because they won the block. I should really have explained the rules. The tournament went over a round-robin format, so all 12 teams wrestled each other. 2 points for a win, 1 point for a draw, 0 points for a loss. And the team with the top two scores, well, we'll get to the leaders in a moment, but the next team would be Stan Hansen and Dan Spivey. Now, Hansen at this point was the biggest Gaijin star in Japanese wrestling by a long, long way. And you could tell by the crowd reactions, everything he did, everything he was doing, it was something else. And also, I'd like to point out, Dan Spivey, who'd just come off a run as part of the Skyscrapers in WCW, was right at the end of his career. And I quite frankly, having watched Dan Spivey a lot at the time, because I really started watching American Wrestling and WCW in about 1989, didn't think he had a performance like this in him in this tournament. This was something else. There is a lot of pressure on Dan Spivey purely because he's Stan Hansen's tag team partner. And the reason for that is because Stan Hansen and Bruiser Brody was another legendary tag team in All Japan Pro Wrestling. Stan Hansen and Ted DiBiase lived up to that reputation. So Dan Spivey taking Ted DiBiase's spot as his tag team partner. Oh, and by the way, there was another tag team between Spivey and DiBiase. That was Stan Hansen and Jinichiro Tenryu. They were quite good as well. So there's a pressure on Spivey here to perform to the absolute highest. He has to be the best of the best. In this tournament, he was incredible. He's easily by far the best performance Dan Spivey has in his career. And it's strongly recommended for seeing a guy just step up to the plate and do the things he needs to do to keep his job.
Yeah, I mean, it really shows that when like you said, when the pressure is on and when you're in the right environment, any wrestler can be really good as long as they're surrounded by the right people and they're in the right sort of format that works for them. And this was an example of that, where Dan Spivey, who was never rated as one of the best wrestlers in the world, he put in some really good performances here, and especially teaming with Hansen, who, like you said, was the biggest gaijin star in the country and just could influence the crowd to however he wanted them. It really worked, and Spivey put in some really good performances. I mean, one of the highlights of this whole tournament for me was just watching Stan Hansen's entrance every time and just trying to see if he managed to whip anyone with his rope.
Yeah.
Like, just such a ridiculous entrance, isn't it? Where he comes out just swinging this rope around crazily. Like, he's not even looking. He's just like whipping it around. Like,
yeah.
Everyone's running away. It's fun to watch, but I think I would have hated to be there at the time as a fan. Just like, oh God, no, I'm getting whipped in the face. but no, I really enjoyed this team. And this was something that I noticed with this team and with Gordy and Williams, who we'll talk about in a minute, where throughout, they obviously played sort of the heel gaijin, and they did such a great job of cheating when it was needed, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So the way they formatted their matches, they'd always have little moments where the babyface team would look like they're about to win, and just at that last second, someone would come in and stomp the pin, or someone would. There was one moment in particular that I really liked where I've forgotten who they were against. We'll get to it in a bit because it'll be in my notes and I'll remember. But whoever the opponents were had Spivey down and were beating on him. And Hansen stepped into the ring behind the referee's back, but then Spivey managed to sort of get an eye rake or something and get on the advantage. And so Hansen just sort of stepped straight back out the opposite ropes and made it look as though he was just like looking around and just whistling. And the crowd just went crazy booing him because they saw exactly what he was trying to do. But he just... the most casual thing, just step in, step out, and gets that reaction. It was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, it's also hard for, like, a guy. You look at Hansen's matches all the way through this tournament, and anytime you see Hansen, he's just 100% go. You know, he's a guy who's 280 pounds, he's 6'5", he's go. He doesn't stop. Everything is movement. There is always movement from the moment he gets his ring gear on. You can tell because when they do shots of him in the back before he comes out, he's dancing on the balls of his feet. That's how he gets geared up for the matches. They run to the ring, like you said, with that ridiculous entrance, whipping people with his bull rope, and then he's dancing on the balls of his feet all the way through that particular the announcements, and then it's go, and he just doesn't slow down. And even when he's selling, he looks so intense.
Yeah, And he can't stay in his corner throughout any of the matches. He's always running around the ring and beating up on the guy who's on the opposite corner, or pulling people out of the ring and throwing them into the crowd. Or, like you said, he just doesn't stay still. He's always doing something.
Only when he is stood still on the ropes, he's shouting, "Come on, Danny! Yeah. Come on, you can do this! Come on, Danny!" You know, all the things you would do in a team environment.
Yeah, Definitely. Yeah. It makes him really just fun to watch because you can watch a match and just watch Stan Hansen and still be entertained.
Yeah, yeah. None more so in the final, which we'll get to in a moment or two. But Hansen was a force of nature, you know. He's a guy that he was had such a long career up until that point and just bulled his way through that career as well in All Japan Pro Wrestling. He would still be wrestling for All Japan 9 or 10 years later. And it's just fascinating to watch him at the time because he's the top Gaijin star. He's over like Rover with that crowd. They can't wait to see what he's going to do next. And it's quite remarkable because he'd had such a long run up until that point. He's kind of not in the Triple Crown picture anymore, but he's still so beloved. And also just so stiff. Just so stiff. Partly because he couldn't see what the hell he was doing and that lariat was, you know... He's admitted himself he's like half blind.
He's legally blind, isn't he?
Yeah, he's legally blind. Also slightly deaf, so forget calling spots. Stan's doing what he wants to do.
Yeah, just keep an eye on him. If he throws a punch at you, try and duck, I guess. Or just try and take it as best you can.
Yeah, as Michael Hayes said, the scariest thing in pro wrestling is standing up, looking at Stan Hansen, who's eyeing you up for a lariat. Because you don't know where it's going to land. You just close your eyes and hope it hits you square in the chest. And if it doesn't, oh well.
Make sure you stand up straight.
Yes. And yeah, so they were just incredible. Just to watch the energy that they had as a tag team and the technical skills that they had as well. Which brings us to the team that won the points tally outright, which was Dr. Death Steve Williams and Terry Bam Bam Gordy, the Miracle Violence Connection, the best named tag team ever, and arguably the best tag team ever. I wrote a lot about this team for WrestleTalk TV a couple of years ago, and if you go to the Forgotten Tag Teams articles I wrote for WrestleTalk TV, you can find out lots of my opinions and a full rundown of this tournament and what happened in it, because I've been fascinated with Doc and Gordy for years. These were the team that were... You heard so much about, but you didn't see the stuff that they were doing because of access. And now you can go back and analyze what they're doing, and they're so impressive as a team. Pair of natural athletes. Gordy had all that time in the Fabulous Three Birds to figure out how he was going to sell himself to an audience. He had all that poise, all that posture. Steve Williams is an animal of a natural athlete, and he has all that intensity that he brings to the wrestling ring. Steve Williams could be intense about a ham sandwich. He's just that good, and that, you know, you truly believe that these two people are badasses that could hurt you, and they were.
Yeah, I really like these guys. Just two big bruisers, two big power guys, especially Williams, who you just saw throughout any shot he threw or any slam he hit. Like you said, he was just intense. He'd really lay it in, and it just looked great. Right from the entrance where they both come sprinting out to the ring and then they're running the ropes, and you know these guys really mean business, and they had some really good matches throughout, especially that the final was against Hansen and Spivey. So such a great team with so much intensity and presence, and just when they're in the ring you're captivated by them and you just want to see what they can do, because they do make it look so legitimate. They look like they are just beating the hell out of their opponents. And when they're in there with the right guys, which a lot of the time here they were, it just makes for some really great matches.
Yeah, I mean, my recommendations are the ones with the British Bruisers, Dynamite and Johnny Smith, which was fantastic. And, you know, even then, it would have been really easy for both of them to shut Dynamite down. You know, they were 60 pounds heavier and just as tough as Dynamite. Yet they kind of let him have his moment because they understood how over he was and they could use that to their advantage. And the matches they had with Baba and Andre, because you've got four guys with great wrestling IQs who know how to make what they've got work. But the really, really impressive ones are Masaru and Kawada. You know, and Teu and Saruta, the fans are absolutely jumping out the streets for the seats for those matches. So they were incredible at the time. and still are to this day, because you don't really get wrestlers like them anymore. The Revival is probably the closest you get, and the Revival are kind of the Doc and Gordy size with the attitude of the Midnight Express, which makes them really, really cool to watch. But you don't get that level of real natural athlete intensity from anyone in pro wrestling anymore. I'm not sure you can either.
Aside from maybe Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and Jim Ross has said numerous times, if UFC had been around in the early, mid-1980s, Steve Williams would not have been a pro wrestler. He would have been an MMA fighter, and he'd been a very successful one. You know, he was as tough as they came. And it's, you know, it's sad when we look back at them now, because Steve Williams died of cancer a couple of years ago, and obviously Terry Bam Bam Gordy is one of the high-profile deaths from the 1990s. And Terry Gordy's death is nothing to do with pro wrestling, unfortunately. It's more to, well, it is, but not directly. It's the extracurricular activities that he was up to at the time that caused him so many health issues. But they are absolutely stunning as a tag team. And if you want to see great tag team wrestling, Miracle Violence Connection are it. So we came to the final. This was, like you said, Alex, at Budokan Hall. This was intensity. You know, it all starts out so nicely. Everyone's introduced so nicely. And then Stan Hansen and Dan Spivey run down to the ring with Hansen's screaming of youth, as he usually does. By the way, found out this morning, the reason why he screamed youth, that was the noise he was making when he raised his hayforks up high and went, youth! The reason why he did that was because Brody and Hansen were matched up with the Funks when they first started in All Japan Pro Wrestling. They were the younger team, so they were trying to get over as the youthful Texas team rather than the old guys who were the Funks. And it just stuck with him through his housing career, which I thought was really interesting, because it's kind of a face move for a guy who's really a heel. So it was interesting how they developed that and how they developed that angle. So they come running to the ring. Dan's kind of along for the ride here, though. He's got his big old scary eyes, and then they get into the ring.
Yeah, I made a note of during that backstage, they had like a little backstage shot of both teams before the match, and Dan Spivey had some crazy eyes going on. It was something to see.
Yes, it is. And then you get Doc and Gordy, who look so intense and so fired up for this match, and they run to the ring, and then it's interesting because the first few moments of this match are actually kind of slow. It takes a while for things to get going. Bam Bam and Spivey start things off, and it takes a little while to get going. And interestingly, Ted DiBiase said about working with Stan Hansen, quite often Stan would say, "We're going to start this slow." And then he said, "That would never happen." Because it's Stan, and he can't do anything but move really, really quickly. So this was interesting to me that actually this did start slow, and it was slow build back and forth. And especially with that final, people were toughing things out. And if just because one team was dominant didn't mean that the person who was underneath was just going to hot tag straight out again. They were going to stick around and try and wear their opponents out.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you say it started slow, but there was still quite a lot of sort of quick tags in and out. There was never the same two guys in the ring for too long, which I thought was pretty smart from both teams, because you have these, obviously you've got four big guys who want to beat the hell out of each other, and so they want to stay as fresh as they can throughout the start of this match and try and wear the other guys down. And it's sort of both teams trying to sort of one-up each other, I guess, where they're both like, yeah, switching in and out and trying to outdo the others, wear them down, tire them out, and try and get that advantage. And I guess it's a sort of a classic Hansen thing where it is all go, even when it's slow action, and they're not, when they are in the ring, they're not really doing too much. It's just sort of chain wrestling-y stuff, but it's still all go with tags in and out and always movement around the ring.
Yeah, and you know, you can tell that they have a strategy. Doc and Gordy are trying to get to the legs of one of them so that Gordy's Scorpion Deathlock can come into play and grind the pace down a bit more, or Williams can put in leg bars, you know, because Williams was actually really technically adept as a wrestler. He had showed a lot of science with his power in this particular tournament. And Gordy had all these tricks that he'd developed down the years for making matches, longer matches work, with all that experience he had in Texas and in the AWA as well. So the entertainment factor was really there. The story was really strong. And really the story becomes the frustration of Stan Hansen not being able to keep dominant for a long period of time, because that's what he wants to do.
Yeah, I mean, I found it interesting story-wise that we had the two big heel Gaijin teams here in the finals. And so going in, the crowd sort of, I don't know if they knew who to side with. They sort of sided with Hansen as the sort of de facto babyface. Just, I'm guessing, because he is the biggest Gaijin star around and he has that established sort of base behind him. And you see throughout the match that him and Spivey start to play sort of, I guess, the baby faces without really being baby faces. They're still using a lot of heel tactics and a lot of sort of brawling and cheating and, you know. But
Yeah,
story-wise, you have Williams and Gordy, like you said, targeting the legs and trying to get their submissions, wear down these guys who Hansen just wants to come in there and beat the hell out of people and just kick the shit out of them, basically. And they're not letting him do it, which I really like. It makes psychological sense that if you're against Dan Hansen, you're not going to let him do what he wants to do. You're going to keep him grounded and you're going to wear him down. It makes sense and it worked for them.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah, it's such a well-told story as well. And Spivey plays his part too. You know, Spivey's trying to get his height involved. If he's on the mat in a leg lock, he can't do anything. Whereas if he's upright, he can start doing power bombs, which is really what he's after. So they're telling this story incredibly well. And it does break down. But one good thing I did notice was, as well, the fans hated it when anyone broke up a submission attempt. You know, if like when I think Hansen breaks up the Scorpion and Gordy breaks up a chokehold, and the fans boo them incessantly because they've cheated to get out of the pinning predicament. So that's really interesting how the fans reacted to that. You know, they're cheering the, like you said, two heel teams really, but they kind of like, it's kind of a bit more down to character choice. The characters of Doc and Gordy and the characters of Hansen and Spivey will choose to do this because they're professionals, they're mercenaries, they want that 10,000 yen and the world tag team titles and the real world determination tag team title trophies, because that means more money for them. That means they're a bigger draw. That means they're going to go further up the card, which is all in this presentation of wrestling as a real sport.
Yeah, for sure. And on that point of crowd reaction, it was something I noticed throughout where they wouldn't boo things like people being hit with chairs or brawling or stuff like that, but they would go crazy whenever someone broke up a pin or a submission. I don't know if it's because of back in the time there was a lot more sort of respect for the rules from the fans, and nowadays we've sort of been a bit desensitized to that, where every tag match has people breaking up the pin because that's just what you do. Whereas back here, it was more of a heel tactic that was used. And even if a babyface did it, as we saw in some earlier matches, the crowd hated it. I don't know if it's just a shift in sort of crowd mindset over the past 25 years or what.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think it's partly these days you're kind of you're right, it's immune to the fans that tend to be slightly immune to what's going on as far as that stuff's concerned, because you've seen it so many times. And if you disqualified a few more people about it, they'd soon kind of get the idea that that's not what you're supposed to do. I mean, WWE and Harry Smith has been very vocal about this. He doesn't like the way that WWE set up their tag team matches because you're not allowed to do these kind of saves, and after one save you get disqualified, you know. So you can't do these big back and forth matches like All Japan has, or even New Japan has in this day and age, because you can't have that many number of saves. But I think as well it was a storytelling device, and it's all about desperation to win the championship in this particular case. So it works and it's fine and you can get away with it, but you can't do it in every match.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so the match continues and it's really serious and intense, and eventually it kind of breaks down. There's a lot of brawling outside the ring, but when it comes to the finishing sequence, there is that clear lineage of the King's Road style where you can't just finish a guy off with one finishing maneuver. You've got to get a bunch of stuff together. And that's more complicated because you've got to get the other guy out of the way. You know, if you go back to earlier in the tournament, there's one point where Stan Hansen throws Jumbo Saruta like three rows back to make sure he can't come in interfere with a pin. He just literally grabs him and turfs him over the railing, and he lands somewhere off shot. So, you know, it's very realistic as to how they're going to stop these pinfalls from happening.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. Like we said, both guys here, or all four guys even, both teams, really want to win. And so that even if they're beaten down, they're going to break up that pin no matter what. So you really have got to isolate the partner and get them out of the picture before you can try and get a pin.
Yeah.
And how was it that this... I'm just looking back at my notes to see exactly what happened in this finishing sequence because there was so much going on.
Well, there was a ton of stuff going on, and eventually Doc manages to get a lariat onto Dan Spivey. And the only fluff of the entire tournament is the fact that the bell goes just as the referee's hand hits three.
That's something I was going to ask you about, actually.
Yeah, and I don't know
because Williams, Doc hits Spivey, he hits Hansen even with a big power slam. He sort of, Hansen goes for a lariat, I think. And Doc sort of ducks him and gets him into a power slam, pins him, and then it's on the two count, the bell rings, and Hansen gets up straight after the pin and looks pissed off, and Williams is still down selling on the mat, and just Hansen starts kicking him in the face and looks really annoyed. I'm like, what's going on here? Is this some sort of story? Were they not meant to win? I don't know. It just looked like something had definitely been flubbed, and I was going to ask you if there was any story behind that.
Not as far as I know. I haven't looked at too many other people's opinions because I wanted to give my own opinions on this particular one. And I think what probably happened was it was just an over-enthusiastic timekeeper who just saw the hand going down and thought, oh, three, and got there too early. You know, because it wasn't like he went ding, 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 ding. It went ding once, then he realized his mistake, and then it went ding, ding, ding after the three count. And to be honest, the way Stan reacted is the way Stan reacts to every time he lost a match. So I don't think it was necessarily, I don't think it was unlikely. Because as well, if you look at the direction of All Japan at the time, Terry Gordy had just come off a Triple Crown reign. Steve Williams was being built up for something big, and that's the reason why he was with Gordy, to give him something long term to do, to build him up as a character. So I think it was, you know, just a reasonable mistake.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I thought there may have been something more there, but maybe that is it. And it did. It sort of ended the match in a bit of a... I guess it got the crowd going a bit crazy about it. It got a good reaction, but it did just seem a bit confusing.
Yeah.
Up until... Especially because you have Doc and Gordy really selling afterwards. They're both down, they're both just out of it, and the referee's trying to pull them up, and they're both just out. And it makes you think, you know, are these guys really, really the winners here? But no, they were. And yeah, it was a good match overall, though.
It was. It was fantastic. You know, Finn Martin, I was talking with him for the Wrestling Histories podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he told me how much he loved this match. You know, it was one of the great, great tag team matches of its era. And certainly, you know, he couldn't believe it when he saw it, what he saw these guys doing. So it's strongly recommended as a great tag team wrestling match, and certainly something you should look into from a historical point of view. Now, after the matches, Doc and Gordy were presented with the trophies, the championship belts, and a check for 10,000 yen. And then interviewed in perhaps the most awkward post-match interview ever, where the interviewer asked a question, the translator translated it for them, and then Doc completely ignored the question and just said what he wanted to anyway. Which was, Merry Christmas, it's great to be number one in Japan. whilst getting the other teams over as well. And similarly, Doc did a similar kind of thing. And get well soon, Giant Babu, because Babu had been ill at that particular point. So it was really an...
Wait, so was Babu ill as he was wrestling in this tournament, or did he get ill sort of halfway through?
I'm not really sure. I can't remember what the reports were at the time, but I think he possibly could have had an injury or was ill during this tournament. So
Because he put in some good performances if he was ill.
Yeah, and or maybe he got injured in those good performances because he was putting in a lot of effort for a guy of his age as well.
Yeah, that's true.
So that really kind of wraps up that match and wraps up the tournament. But it was important to All Japan Pro Wrestling in the coming months because, as you see, in the next year is really the rise of Kawada and Misawa as main characters in All Japan Pro Wrestling. And Misawa is starting to get to that stage of super over, as is Kawada. Teo and Kobashi start to develop themselves and give themselves a major presence in this tournament. So the actual, like, what was your impressions on the tournament and how do you feel it kind of influenced what was going to go forward into 1991 and the future?
I mean, this was a tournament where you had sort of your stars of the future really shone throughout. So you have your Taoways, your Kobashis, your Misawas, your Kawadas, really showing why they should be the top stars for the, sort of the next generation. And this was sort of a bit of a coming out tournament for them where they all put in some fantastic performances. I think especially Misawa and Kawada were fantastic. And yeah, it really, it starts to set up that new style of wrestling in All Japan and this new crop of stars for what would become possibly the greatest sort of period of professional wrestling throughout the 90s in this company.
Yeah, I agree. This is kind of like the foundations of everything that's going to come forward with the King's Road style as well. So it is really important that you understand and watch this tournament if you want to understand really what's going to happen with FMW, with Noah, with All Japan Pro Wrestling, to a lesser extent, Big Japan Wrestling in the future as well. This is all building towards something which is King's Road style. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast today, and I hope you enjoyed listening to us to talk about the Real World Tag League in 1990. I'd like to thank my guest for today, Mr. Alex Edwards. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It was a fun one.
Yeah, it's something that's a bit different, and because again, me and Alex kind of come from a New Japan background, it's great to look back at these All Japan matches and just realize how good they actually were.
Yeah, because I'm like you, the listeners, where I haven't really watched much All Japan before, and so going back and watching these is really me watching all this stuff for the first time and seeing why we are where we are today and sort of seeing where all this stuff came from, which is really interesting.
Okay then, so if you would like to listen to other podcasts on the WrestleTalk Podcast Network, The Squash is back and is audio only on SoundCloud, iTunes, and wherever you get your podcasts from. Ben Spindler taking over from Paul Taylor and having fun with Gavin Duenas. I'd really like the Getting to Know Gavin Duenas feature. Model railway enthusiast extraordinaire, our bud Gavin Duenas. So have a listen to them. You can listen to Wrestling Histories with me and Finn Martin on WrestlePlus. $4.99 a month with great wrestling content. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week. Bye.